I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Iowa is not just a farm state. Its politics are very much tied up with corn and soybeans, hogs and chickens. In fact, corn and soybeans are grown on most of the state's millions of acres of cropland. There are more than 20 million hogs in Iowa, and it's home to big chicken farms and food processing plants. Our guest Richard Manning writes about agriculture and the environment, and he has a story in the February edition of Harper's titled The Trouble with Iowa, and it's about the impact of farming on the state's water and politics, and we asked him to join us on the Radio Times today. And Richard Manning, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. I think people used to the East Coast with its cities and sprawling suburbs might be surprised if they go to Iowa to drive across the state. What is that like?
Yeah, they'd be surprised on a couple of levels. Everybody has an image of what a farm state looks like, and it's kind of a bucolic image of yeoman farmers and nice red barns and that sort of thing. And they'd be surprised to not find that. That's not the way it is at all. And I know quite a bit about farming just because I've been writing about it for a long time, but I was actually surprised this time I was in Iowa at some of the changes that they observed while I was there. For one thing, it's silent, and that's a very odd thing to drive through the countryside and have everything be absolutely silent, see
wow.
No animals, no people, no sign of wildlife whatsoever. That's kind of new.
And is it just what you see are fields of corn? What do you see that's creating this silence?
Yeah, that's part of it. And you expect to see corn in Iowa. That's been true since the Civil War, really. They've grown a lot of corn there, but now it's everywhere. It's a blanket that's on the state. They have something like 24 million acres of cropland. 23 million of those acres are in corn or soybeans. That's all they grow, and they grow it fence row to fence row. There's just it's unrelenting. But what you don't see, and this is really interesting in a way, when you mention there are 20 million hogs there, you'd expect to see pigs, or you expect to see chickens or cows. You don't see those either. Everything is in buildings that look like a giant Costco store. And there's kind of an interesting connection why they look that way. But at any rate, those where the animals are, they're inside of factory farms. And inside of those buildings, and the industry would prefer you not see what's inside of those buildings, are climate-controlled places where pigs stand literally shoulder to shoulder for the 6 months of their lives and get fast as they rapidly can.
Let me pick up on several things that you said. Let me go back to corn and go back to ethanol. And I assume one of the reasons that Iowa grows so much corn is because of the renewable fuel standard, something that was passed almost a decade ago. Does that explain just how much corn there is in Iowa?
Yeah, it doesn't explain how much corn there is. It does, to agree. I'll take that back. But, yeah, it's something we did not expect looking at domestic agriculture. Maybe 15 years ago, people saw ethanol coming as well. That'll take up maybe 5% of the corn crop. It's now taking up 40%. And you're absolutely right that it would not be grown or it would not be consumed that way without the subsidy. It's just simply the heavy hand of the federal government saying, thou shalt. And, of course, this factors heavily into the presidential politics that are playing out in Iowa right now.
Do people talk about the big government of ethanol subsidies?
Yeah, to a degree. In Iowa, it's perfectly acceptable by most of the conservatives there running in the Republican Party and all of the Democrats running to have the big government take care of this ethanol subsidy. That's considered a good thing and not government meddling at all. The lone exception to that has been Ted Cruz, and he came out quite early against the ethanol subsidy. And what's interesting now is, especially in the last week or so, the degree that that's playing in the dynamic of this race. And it is very dynamic. I mean, the back and forth between Trump and Cruz in Iowa is being driven by the ag industry coming out against Cruz on the ethanol subsidy, or his stand on the ethanol subsidy.
In fact, the governor came out against Cruz as well, telling people don't vote for this guy.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
It is.
And the governor is kind of a neutral guy in this and said he would be neutral. And also Senator Grassley came out and not endorsing Trump, but showed up to introduce him at a rally. And that's kind of a backhanded way of endorsing Trump. And I think it's exactly the same reason.
So what is the impact? And this is something that you write about in your piece in Harper's, the impact of so much. It's an agricultural state. So much of the cropland devoted to soybeans and to corn. What is the effect of runoff, of fertilizers, of pesticides on the water in Iowa? So much focus, of course, on Flint, Michigan, but let's talk about Iowa and its water.
And that's a good context to talk about it, is Flint. Flint, Michigan is really different in a lot of ways, but it's the same in a lot of ways. And how it's different is this is agricultural pollution. People don't think of agriculture as being as polluting as it really is, but it's now our leading source of degradation of water quality in the nation. And this is mostly because of nitrogen fertilizers, or at least what we know of is because of nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers that run off the fields, both the farm fields where the corn is growing, but also the hog manure, and pollutes the streams. And it causes nitrogen pollution in the streams, and there's a standard for that for public health,
right,
that we shouldn't drink that nitrogen. Almost all of the Iowa streams are in violation of that standard on some level, to the point now that the Des Moines Water Works, and that's the organization that supplies all the drinking water for the city of Des Moines and the surrounding suburbs, has filed suit against the agricultural industry there, saying, you guys got to clean this up because we're faced with the costs of cleaning this up. But that shows up downstream in some really nasty issues like the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So the Gulf of Mexico has an area that's hypoxic, or it means it can't support marine life simply because of these very fertilizers. And while Iowa occupies only about 5% of that watershed, Iowa contributes 25% of the pollution that's causing that problem in the Gulf of Mexico, several states away.
You write that a third of Iowa's farmland has drain pipes underground, obviously to deal with some of this runoff. Does that get piped into streams, and then streams go into rivers, and that creates the situation in the Gulf of Mexico?
Exactly so. The science on this is not much more difficult than water runs downhill. And most of Iowa, or not most, but about a third of Iowa was underwater when people started settling the place. It was swamps, wetlands, and couldn't be farmed at all. The only way they were able to farm it was by putting in the drainage tiles that you mentioned here. That makes a very efficient system for funneling off this water and the nitrogen and the phosphorus directly to rivers. And it's untreated in any way whatsoever.
Where's the EPA on this?
The EPA is kind of at an interesting point. And EPA is where it is in every other state that has this problem right now, which is it's sitting on its hands. Now, that's not unfair in a way, because its hands are tied by the law. The 72 Clean Water Act, which is really our monumental piece of clean water legislation in the United States, the reason that we had for a while clean rivers, exempted, and some of the resulting, subsequent legislation, exempted what's called non-point source. What that means is the pollution doesn't come out of a factory or a sewage treatment plant, and it runs off fields. Therefore, it's exempt from the Clean Water Act.
Wow.
Now, what's being argued in Iowa right now is that, hey, this stuff is coming out of a pipe, and so we should regulate it. But the stance of the EPA is this is non-point source. Therefore, these guys can do whatever they want, and we'll not regulate.
Are people afraid, and we'll be talking with a reporter from Des Moines, but are people in Iowa afraid to drink the water?
I heard some of that, yes. And first of all, if you live in a city, the water is treated, so they're paying the money. And in the Des Moines case, they're facing like a $180 million upgrade to remove the nitrogen from their plant. So if you're in a city, it's probably removed and you're meeting the standard. If you think the standard is safe, there are some people who say we shouldn't be drinking even that much nitrogen. Where it becomes an issue is in outside of the cities, where people have wells and drilling into the aquifer. And, of course, those are polluted as well, but not nearly as closely monitored. But there's a separate issue here, and it's not quite separate. We're talking about the nitrogen pollution, and that's toxic probably in the long term. But there are also algal blooms from blue-green cyanobacteria, algae. And those are caused by the fertilizer. So here's algae that likes the fertilizer, and it proliferates. When it does, a certain species of this bacteria creates toxins, actually things that are poison almost immediately. And last year, the city of Toledo had an outbreak of this very toxin that meant that people in Toledo had to drink bottled water simply because water was poisonous. And that's a bigger issue and more prevalent in things like streams and lakes where wildlife are and dogs drink, that kind of thing.
You mentioned hogs, and if we're going to talk about hogs, we have to talk about manure because that's what happens. Almost 21 million hogs in Iowa. I think there are about, 3 or 4 million people in Iowa, so of course many more hogs than people. But you do write in your piece, Richard, is that the waste from hogs is the same as the waste from 2.5 people. I'm doing the math here, but let's factor that into the pollution, I guess, that comes from hog farming.
Yeah, exactly so. And so that runs it up to, if we have the equivalent in humans of human waste from the hogs, it's about 45 million, 50 million in that range. And those numbers are a little general, but it's close. And you think about that. Here are 45 million people. No way would we put 45 million people in that landscape without any sort of sewage treatment whatsoever. That's precisely what we're doing with the hogs. And that does not mention the fact there are 50 million chickens there as well, and they're producing the equivalent of probably another 20 million people. So you have the equivalent, in sewage at least, of a really populous state without sewage treatment. That's the issue almost anywhere where we're doing factory farming. And that we've been talking so far about the pollution from nitrogen and phosphorus as a result of that. And, of course, that's a tremendous issue. That's the biggest issue. But what's not being monitored is some other issues that flow along with this, chief among those antibiotics. Every single animal in every single one of those factory farms is fed routinely every day antibiotics. It's the only way the system can work because of their diet, because of their confinement. Antibiotics are necessary to prop them up, to allow them to live long enough so we can kill them. And because of that, there are all sorts of concerns about antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and because we're doing this massive science experiment. And the Centers for Disease Control says this is an enormous problem, that about 23,000 people a year die in the United States because of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. We're not monitoring this, and we're not checking out what's happening in this science experiment that's being conducted in our public waterways.
Richard, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Let me reintroduce you. That's Richard Manning, who's joining us in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about Iowa. We're talking about farm policy, the impact of farming on the environment in Iowa. And he writes about agriculture and the environment, and wrote a piece in the February edition of Harper's called The Trouble with Iowa. That's what we're talking about in this portion of Radio Times. I should add, his most recent book is called Go Wild, Free Your Body and Mind from the Afflictions of Modern Civilization, and that's co-authored with psychiatrist John Rady. We're going to talk much more about Iowa and corn and hogs, and we'll open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Iowa, corn, and politics. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about corn and politics in Iowa. Our guest is Richard Manning. He writes about agriculture and environment as a writer. And we're talking about the influence that local politics and big agricultural companies are having on the presidential race in Iowa. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Richard, this wasn't a big part of your piece in Harper's, but you do mention the fact that with big factory farms and also with some of these processing facts or slaughterhouses, how much is Iowa dependent on illegal immigration in order to keep this part of the state's industry afloat?
Well, the system is extensive and has a vast network of tentacles out into the countryside and into the American's diet. But there are these little pinch points in there, every place where it kind of comes together in a neck. One of those in Iowa, and a crucial one, is the slaughterhouse system. So when you have 21 million hogs, those hogs, and of course the corn itself, is useless until those hogs are actually dead and made into food. And that happens in a series of processing plants in the state, a handful of maybe 10 of them. not quite that many, maybe six or eight. And they kill routinely 18,000 hogs a day.
Wow.
If you can imagine that.
I can't.
And they are almost wholly dependent on immigrant or Hispanic labor. In the Midwest, and these are throughout the Midwest, not just in Iowa, these towns are called Little Mexicos. And that's kind of the hypocrisy in the system when you have a state that's being run to a certain extent on anti-immigrant politics right now, that Donald Trump especially is espousing there, and the fact that their economy is wholly dependent on labor from people from outside the state, essentially, that now move there to do their dirty work.
What is Pizza Ranch, and how does that factor in the presidential race?
That's one of those lovely little systems that you can kind of only have in as these things come together in the weird weave of politics and food that goes on. But Pizza Ranch is almost an obligatory stop for anybody who's campaigning in Iowa right now, but especially Republicans. And Mike Huckabee claims credit for the Pizza Ranch strategy. It's a chain of fast food restaurants, but it happens to be a chain that's run by evangelicals. So you can go to the website and you can say, well, I would like to order a pizza, and by the way, can you pray for me? And you fill in a form and they'll pray for you, whatever your need happens to be. And so all the candidates go there and talk about the issues that affect our lives while they're eating the very fast food that is really responsible for the environmental problems, but also the health problems that we have in this nation. And the irony is too rich to ignore.
Well, and I'm thinking also about the kind of corn syrup, or I guess high fructose corn syrup, that comes from corn, obviously, and the way that is now packaged so almost completely into our American diet.
Yeah, and that's a big deal, and we should be really conscious of that. So if we were to analyze what corn syrup has done, and not just corn syrup, but all sugars, but corn syrup is just another form of sugar. What sugars have done to us have created the obesity crisis that we live in now, and obesity crisis is really responsible for something like 1 in 5 of our health care dollars in the United States. That's a lot of money. But it's also created things like type 2 diabetes in children. And that's unconscionable. We did not have type 2 diabetes in children a generation ago. Corn syrup in Iowa was kind of the precursor to ethanol in a way. I mean, 20 years ago, the industry was heavily concentrated on ways to really get more corn into corn syrup. So since the Civil War, the job of Iowa's agribusiness is to make corn disappear. And a huge proportion of that corn is disappearing into corn syrup that is causing the very health problems that we're fighting across the nation.
Let me see what Kevin from Pennsylvania has to say. Kevin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times, on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I had a question. This is in regards to the Clean Water Act and the factory farms. The fact that they have all these factory farms and all the animals housed in these large warehouse-type buildings, wouldn't that then give the EPA the opportunity to enforce the Clean Water Act on them? Because then that would be a point source of the pollution.
Rather than a non-point source, right, Kevin?
Yep.
Can you take that, Richard Manning?
Yeah, very good question, and it's a question that's been asked in the courts. And so it does, if they were to take, and the manure is liquid, by the way, in these factory farms, if they were to take a pipe from the liquid manure pit and put it into the river and make it go to the river, then you could regulate. That's what the courts have said. But if you take that same manure, spread it on a field where there is a pipe about 2 feet below the surface, that is not regulated. And there's actually case law on that that's been determined. And so it's the kind of boxes, that the bureaucratic boxes that get checked here to say, well, we're doing our job.
But we're talking farming, so we're talking manure here. But isn't manure a good source of fertilizer for land, Richard?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And so if it was handled properly, that it could actually replace a lot of chemical fertilizers, and that's what they're doing with it, essentially. The problem is there's so much of it. So with 21 million hogs, they have an abundance of riches, if you will, and so an embarrassment of riches, I mean. And so because of that, they dispose of it as quickly as they possibly can. They put it on far too concentrated levels. The timing is wrong. And all those things combine to make sure that a certain, a huge proportion of it actually runs off into rivers and streams. Some of it does indeed fertilize corn. And if we weren't concentrating the animals so heavily into these factory farms, then the manure wouldn't be a problem. We could handle that, and we can handle it in some really creative ways, but that's not what was being done.
Well, what would be those creative ways? Because I don't think you're arguing that we need, or maybe you are, that we need to reduce the number of hogs that are raised in Iowa, or the numbers of chickens, or even maybe the amount of land dedicated to growing corn and soybeans. What is the way out?
Well, less concentration, it's certainly moving away from feedlot agriculture, and that certainly would mean raising fewer hogs and chickens in the state. But here's an interesting number here, is, and most Americans won't realize this, but per capita consumption of chicken has doubled in the United States since 1969. And that's solely a result of these factory farms. In other words, it's like corn that way. We produce so many chickens now that marketers have figured out a way to make us eat more chickens. And the same with pork. So that's kind of a long-winded way of saying, no, we can grow meat, but in these more creative ways. So I'm a great proponent, for instance, of grass-fed beef, which is now pretty much available all across the country and is a very rapidly growing area of the industry. And it's healthier for you, but it's also healthier for the landscape because the animals are out on permanent pastures as opposed to eating corn from plowed up fields, fertilized fields. So there are ways we can produce meat successfully. We can't do it in the factory model that's come to dominate and control the countryside of Iowa.
Grass-fed meat tends to be very expensive, at least today.
Yeah, well, food should be expensive, and one of the reasons we're in this mess is people have looked for ways to make it cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. The problem is that the cheaper food we have is not as nutritionally good as the things like grass-fed beef. So grass-fed beef, for instance, has much higher in omega-3 fatty acids, which we should be eating. We need those for brain development. They're in shortage for us. So it's not really cheaper in the long run. And it's certainly not cheaper if we take into account the destruction that is occurring on the landscape that we're not paying for.
You mentioned in your piece that Tom Vilsack, he was the governor of Iowa, now the agriculture secretary, was a reformer. Has he been successful carrying out some of these reform ideas he's had?
Yeah, that little anecdote that's in the piece, I think, is indicative of a much larger picture that's far more significant for America in general. But basically what happened was, and I went into Iowa saying, nobody's going to talk about these issues in this presidential campaign, I'll bet. And I'll bet they won't talk about them while they're literally standing in the fields where the problems are happening or standing among the people who are obese as a result of this diet. And that was true. But it was not true in 2008 that Obama actually captured the Iowa caucuses by really addressing these issues and promising to do reform. And he was going to reform the factory hog system, and Vilsack was appointed Secretary of Agriculture to do exactly that. And they tried very hard to do that reform, and they were honest about it, and they were straightforward about it. And they said, "We're going to reform this system. This is not going to happen any longer." Well, they got beat. And they got beat very badly by the lobbying efforts that took place in Congress and things like AstroTurf groups supporting the industry. That model is something that we need to pay very close attention to, because the industry, especially in rural America, especially in the red states, especially where we do things not just agriculture, but energy production and mining, is environmentally destructive. And so they've gotten very, very good at subverting regulation and subverting environmental restrictions. So good at it that it really doesn't matter who's leading the country, they're able to subvert that regulation.
The one candidate that seems to be pushing back against the use of ethanol and some of these subsidies is Ted Cruz. Now, he is from Texas, which is a oil and gas-rich state, so that does complicate things a little bit. But he seems to be hanging in there in Iowa. Do you think that's indicative of anything, Richard?
Yeah, I do. And so he's hanging there in there for things like the evangelical vote and people who are worried about imposition of Sharia law in Iowa. And those are the kind of the distractions that take place in this campaign. But the network that is supporting him and certainly will support him if he's a nominee are the people like the Koch brothers, who are very good, have created the very system I'm talking about. They have designed a system to subvert environmental regulation. That was why they went into business 50 years ago or 40 years ago, and they've largely succeeded in that. And that's what will come to prevail no matter who the Republican nominee is.
So you're saying it doesn't matter who's in the White House? This is the system that we have?
It absolutely matters who's in the White House for a lot of issues, but this is a long-term problem. It took us a long time to get in this, and we shouldn't kid ourselves that who's in the White House is going to fix it tomorrow. This is systemic. They have rewired our political system, and they've rewired it to the point that when somebody turns the switch in Washington to turn the light on in Iowa, the light goes off.
Are we talking about companies, corporations like Tyson, Smithfield, are these the big players in Iowa?
Yeah. So when we were talking about the factory farm system being concentrated, it is now concentrated into five companies that do something like 75% of the hogs, majority of the beef, and also the chickens. Tyson is one of those, but there are Tyson and Smithfield are the leaders in this. Smithfield was the one that did the that Tom Vilsack took on. And Smithfield is now owned by the Chinese, so it's a Chinese corporation, which I find kind of interesting because people talk about tyranny and worry about tyrants taking over and call President Obama, a tyrant, but they're perfectly willing to let the Chinese take over control of the landscape in Iowa.
And that's Richard Manning, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about Iowa. He has an article in the February edition of Harper's called The Trouble with Iowa, and we are talking about the agricultural policies in Iowa and how they get played out politically. And you can join the conversation 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Richard, picking up on what you said about the fact that Smithfield sold part of its company to the Chinese, and then you've got Trump and others who are criticizing Chinese corporations for taking jobs and being, a bad neighbor, so to speak. But when it gets tied up with politics in Iowa, there must be people in Iowa who support the Chinese because they're part of the agriculture economy there.
Yeah, and that goes straight up to the governor, as a matter of fact. So when Trump began speaking ill of the Chinese in the state and how he was going to get tough on the Chinese, Terry Branstad, the governor, immediately broke his silence on the caucus and said, "Now wait a minute, we can't be bad mouthing the Chinese in this state." So it's really indicative of the kind of control that he's able to deliver and the political control in the state. And this is an interesting issue. I've dealt a lot with international agriculture and developing world agriculture, and we saw the question 20 years ago was, who's going to feed the Chinese? And people worried about that and said, well, the Chinese will. And then it started to look like they were going to do places like South Africa, Brazil, and so forth, and they have. But the interesting thing is they're showing up in the United States almost every place I go looking at agriculture now with these factory farming systems. And of course they are, because the United States uniquely offers control of the landscape, political control. And that's really what they're after. They're after this regularity, the predictability that is absolutely necessary for factory farming. And then we can only deliver that in the United States.
Well, Richard Manning, you've given us a lot to think about. Thank you so much for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You can check out his article in Harper's, and it's called The Trouble with Iowa. Well, newsflash, there is a presidential race underway, and the Iowa caucuses are this Monday night. This campaign for the White House is getting relentless coverage because it's an open seat. There are major differences between the parties and the candidates. There's Donald Trump's bombast and surprise popularity among Republicans, and there's Bernie Sanders, who's thrown a monkey wrench into Hillary Clinton's game plan on the Democratic side. We asked Jason Noble to join us to walk us through the caucus process in Iowa, fill us in on what candidates are doing to win over supporters. He's political reporter for the Des Moines Register, host of the podcast Three Tickets. And Jason Noble, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You were just talking with Bernie Sanders. What was the candidate talking about?
Well, he was at a little breakfast get-together here sponsored by Bloomberg Politics in downtown Des Moines, and I had a lot of reporters around the table asking about his campaign kind of strategy going up against Hillary Clinton here in the final days and just sort of outlining his policies and defending them.
And did he say anything that was new and surprising?
A lot of us tried to pin him down on just what his advertising and his messaging was going to look like in relation to Hillary Clinton over the last 2 days here. And I think that we got out of him that he's not going to do any negative advertising, but that he may do contrast advertising. And it's up to us, I guess, to figure out what the difference is between negative ads and contrast ads.
Yeah. Do you know what a difference is between a negative ad and a contrast ad? Or are you?
It sounds like semantics to me.
And I'm assuming because it's Iowa and it's a couple of days before the caucuses that the candidates are everywhere and they want every opportunity to talk to either voters or caucus goers or the press?
That's right. Name a town in Iowa that's probably going to be a candidate there over the next 4 days here. At the Des Moines Register, we maintain a candidate tracker that'll show you every event every day. And it's just wall to wall. I mean, candidates are starting events at 7:38 in the morning and holding events at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And it's going to be like that through Monday. It's really amazing.
It is really amazing. Jason, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. I think we're going to call you back and try to get you on a slightly better phone line and talking about Iowa. Going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Jason Noble. He's a political reporter for the Des Moines Register. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The Iowa caucuses are just 4 days away. The presidential candidates using a full court press to get their supporters to caucus on Monday night. Jason Noble is our guest. He's political reporter for the Des Moines Register, host of the podcast Three Tickets, which examines the history and culture of the Iowa caucuses. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jason, is this caucus season any more frenetic than in previous years? It certainly feels that way over here in Philadelphia.
Oh, I definitely say that it is. I mean, for one thing, you've got competitive races for both parties. That doesn't happen every cycle, obviously, when there's an incumbent in office. So that definitely adds to the energy of it. You've also got a very dynamic race here on the Republican side with a dozen candidates, and most of them really putting in a real campaign here in Iowa. It's definitely a step up in volume from years past.
And I realize it's complicated to walk through the caucus system, and I also have realized that the Democrats' caucus is different from the Republicans. Is there a concise way to describe what's going to happen Monday night? Let's go to a Republican caucus. What's going to happen there?
Sure. The Republican ones are the easy ones. That one is much more traditional, kind of casting a secret ballot. What happens is that there are almost 1,700 precinct sites all across the state. People gather. They're holding this party meeting where they're talking about party business. But the first thing they do is write down their favorite candidate on a slip of paper and cast a vote. And those votes are tallied up across the state, and the guy with the most votes is the winner. So it's
pretty straightforward.
On the Republican side.
Yeah. How about for the Democrats? It gets more complicated.
That's right. The Democrats don't do a straw poll of their support, what they try to do is estimate the support that candidates would take into the state convention. And so what they do is everyone gathers in a room at the precinct site, and they'll actually physically divide up based on who they support. The Hillary Clinton supporters will go stand in that corner, and the Bernie Sanders supporters will go stand in that corner, and the Martin O'Malley supporters will go stand against the other wall. And support is measured that way. They count it up. They figure out a percentage of the people in the room. But it keeps getting more complicated from there. You have this issue called a viability threshold. If you don't have support from 15% of the people in the room, you're declared not viable. And so you have this period where there's this kind of trading going back and forth and people realigning if their candidate isn't viable. And it looks like that's going to be an issue in a lot of places across the state with Martin O'Malley. He is polling about 5% right now. We can surmise that in a lot of precincts, he's not going to have support from 15% of the participants. So then his supporters are going to be up for grabs. And the Bernie Sanders people, the Hillary Clinton people are going to be trying to win them over. And that can be really important because it can affect the way that delegates are assigned out of that precinct, and it can affect the support that the candidates end up with in this complex delegate calculation.
So what is a good turnout for the caucuses on Monday night? What percentage of the people who can go to a caucus, or I guess who can vote in Iowa, tend to go to a caucus?
Turnout in raw numbers is typically around 120,000 or so. That, especially on the Republican side, that's been a pretty consistent figure. Democrats in 2008, the last competitive caucus that we had, it was obviously the year of Barack Obama. There were also very well-run Iowa campaigns by Hillary Clinton and John Edwards, and we saw 240,000 people show up.
Wow.
Almost doubling the previous turnout for a Democratic caucus. Turnout's a big question this year, and there's this feeling that, you know, the higher the turnout, the better off Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are, because they're sort of these non-traditional candidates who are appealing to people who are not, the regular party activists. And so if the turnout's higher this year, that's going to be an indication that they've done a better job of turning their people out. In terms of percentage of the overall electorate, there's about 2 million registered voters mm-hmm. in the state of Iowa that are just about evenly split between Democratic, Republican, and no party independent voters. So if you're looking at about 600,000, between 600,000 and 7,000 registered Democrats, registered Republicans, and about 120 to, say, 200,000 are turning out, 30% turnout-ish.
Yeah, ish. I know you can't really run this experiment, but I was thinking it'd be interesting if you had a primary like other states, if the results would be any different. Has anyone ever looked at that?
I don't know if anyone's kind of run the math on it, but the results would be very different, particularly on the Democratic side. I mean, there is no actual count of votes in a Democratic caucus, so there's no way to know. And then with that realignment period that I was talking about, the votes change. And so, yeah, it would be very different if there was a straight vote. On the Republican side, it's not that different. A primary versus a caucus, you might also get more participation, more independents coming out. But no real way to know.
One of the things that I was also learning about how the caucus works, the caucuses are run by the parties, whereas in states, it's the states that run the primaries. Do I have that right?
That's right.
Do I get an A?
Yeah. The caucuses are an accident of history. I mean, what happened is in 1968, the Democrats went through a very contentious nominating process, and they had this terrible national convention in Chicago where there were literally riots on the streets. And after that, and they nominated a very unpopular Democratic candidate in Hubert Humphrey. And after that, they said, we've got to change this process. We've got to open it up. We've got to get more participation from real voters. And so that's when we saw, primaries and caucuses become more important. And in 1972, the first presidential election of this played out, Iowa just happened to be the first one on the calendar.
Accident of history.
Yeah. And over the last 40-odd years, Iowa's done a very good job of maintaining that place and sort of carving out its niche as the first state in the nation.
But it
and
is...
So, and so,
no, go ahead.
To go back to your point, these are just party meetings. They're not an official election. This was the first caucus date on the calendar where party regulars were getting together to talk about party issues and who they wanted to support for president.
So the caucuses, I mean, they're not really predictive. Yes, Barack Obama won in 2008. But when you look at, I guess, the makeup of people in Iowa, the unusual way that people are caucusing, it's not even called voting. Whoever wins on, Monday night or Tuesday morning, does that mean anything in the big scheme of things, do you think, Jason?
Yeah, you know, I like to remind people that four of the last six presidents were Iowa caucus winners. So it's not a terrible predictor, but that's really not the function of the Iowa caucuses. The people who have watched this process a long time will tell you that the caucus's number one responsibility is to winnow the field. It's to decide, it's to show the rest of the country who's a viable candidate, whose message is resonating with, party activists, and to get rid of the rest of them. And that happens every time there's a caucus, the next day, the next week. There are candidates who drop out and say, okay, well, it's been proven it's on my ear. That's the number one function of the caucuses. Another big thing the caucuses can do is they can really give a candidate momentum and prove that a candidate, has what it takes to move on to New Hampshire and beyond. Barack Obama is a great example of that. For the podcast that I produced, I talked to David Axelrod, who was Obama's chief advisor, and he said, we had to win Iowa. We knew that we had to win here to prove that we were a real candidate and not just a media creation or a good speech.
Jason, let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Jason Noble. He's a political reporter for the Des Moines Register, host of the podcast you just mentioned called Three Tickets. It examines the history and culture of the Iowa caucuses. And we are talking about the fact that Iowans will caucus on Monday night. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jason, we put together a montage of TV ads. I'm not sure they're all running in Iowa, but I just want to play that and then talk about what it's like to turn on your television set when you're in Iowa. Let's give this montage a listen.
We need to take power out of Washington and give it back to the American people.
We must trust one person with the strength to make the right decision to keep us secure.
But I believe we need to lift our vision above the obstacles in place and look to the American horizon.
If one thing is true, America won't accept defeat. Sure, she may have taken a hit, even been knocked down. But that's not the end of the story.
He's been here and listened.
Right here in Iowa.
He understands my generation.
He'll get government off my farm.
The person who lives here has to solve problems as big as the world and as small as your kitchen table. That's the job.
Is he or she godly? Does he or she love us? Can he or she do the job? And finally, would they kill a duck and put him in a pot and make him a good duck gumbo?
That last one from the Duck Dynasties. So, Jason, is that sort of a hint, a taste of what it's like to turn on your TV set in Iowa?
Oh, yeah. The political advertising here is just wall-to-wall. And, I mean, it's on your network TV where you expect it. But if you stream your shows on Hulu or Netflix, you're going to see political advertising. If you go to the Des Moines Register's website, you're probably going to see political advertising surrounding our news content. It's everywhere you go. There's a lot of debate and question about how effective political advertising is, particularly in a state like Iowa with the caucus process that really demands a lot of in-person campaigning. But the campaigns don't take any chances, and they flood the airwaves here for whatever marginal gain they can get out of that.
And look forward to Tuesday morning when everybody leaves.
Yeah. That's right. But, with the advertising, Iowa's also a swing state. And so by July or August, we'll have all the ads right back on our TV screen for the general election.
And can you tell at, what is today, Thursday, at whatever time it is, who's ahead, who's behind on the Republican-Democratic side?
You know, there's always polling in the field. My newspaper, The Register, has a very highly regarded poll. We just announced last night that we'll release our final poll results on Saturday evening. That's traditionally seen as kind of the last best guess of where things are at. Overall, this really looks like a two-person race, both for Democrats and for Republicans. Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are running what appears to be neck and neck on the Republican side, and Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are running very close on the Democratic side. And like I said earlier, there's a sentiment, I think, among a lot of people that it's going to come down to whether the newly engaged and not very politically active people who have really been turned on by Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are actually going to come out and participate in this process on Tuesday night. And the higher the turnout is, the better it is for those candidates. The lower it is, the better it is for Ted Cruz and Hillary Clinton, who are much more traditional candidates who have run very traditional Iowa caucus campaigns.
Well, we are talking about the Iowa caucuses, and you're listening to Ballot Talks here on WHYY. Let me get Mary from, looks like, Lansdale to join our conversation. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was an observer at a Democratic caucus in Iowa several years back, and I noticed that it takes 2 hours and there's no child care provided, and that's kind of bad for women especially. I was wondering if there's been any research about that.
Have you looked at that, Jason?
Well, you know, I know that the Democratic Party here in Iowa and the campaigns are aware of that, and I think that there are caucus sites that do offer child care, but it is definitely not widespread. There's 1,600, 1,700 different caucus sites. Obviously, not all of them are going to have child care. The Democratic Party has taken some steps this year to make the caucuses more available to people with disabilities and military people who might be serving out of state or overseas. So there is a recognition that there's a need to expand and make this process more accessible to people. You know, back in 2008, this was actually something that the Clinton campaign talked about as being a big advantage for Barack Obama. They said, you know, he's bringing out young people and, single people and people who aren't don't have these issues like child care or don't work odd hours or work late into the night. And, you know, they said that's one of the reasons why he did better than us, because his supporters were able to access this process that demands that you be in one place for 2 hours, you know, in the middle of the evening.
Well, and how much does weather matter on caucus night?
It can matter a lot. You know, we're talking about Iowa in February.
And it's got to be really cold, right?
Well, you know, we're actually kind of in a heat wave here. I think it's going to be in the 40s and maybe even up to 50 over the weekend. But there is some forecast out there saying that some kind of winter storm system is going to blow in on Monday night. We'll see. You know, there's definitely a caucus electorate out there that will show up no matter what. But there's a lot of people who maybe first time or more, you know, casual participants in this, who will see the snow blowing in and say, oh, forget it. And I'm sure there's been examples in history where the weather has been determinative.
Jason, on that note, I do want to thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, helping us understand the caucus system in Iowa, and have fun on Monday night.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Jason Noble, political reporter for the Des Moines Register, also host of the podcast Three Tickets, and that examines the history and culture of the Iowa caucuses. We began with Richard Manning, author and essayist who writes a lot about agriculture and the environment. And in the February edition of Harper's, he's got a story there titled The Trouble with Iowa. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.